Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. Hi, I'm John DeLynn. Welcome to Mormon Stories Podcast. Today, I'm very excited and honored to have as a special guest, Mr. Bruce Bastian. He's probably most commonly known as one of the co-founders of WordPerfect Corporation, which in his day was the premier word processor provider on the personal computer. But it was a major player in the computer industry, especially in those early years. Bruce Bastian has been a champion of the arts, the performing arts, not just in Utah, but across the country. He's the founder of the Bruce Bastian Foundation. And also, he's done a lot of work for LGBT issues, for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues. And he also was raised a member of the LDS Church. And so today we're going to talk about all of that, hopefully. But Bruce, I just want to extend you a warm welcome to Mormon Stories Podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be part of it.
Thanks for coming on. Well, I thought it would make sense to begin just by talking about your early years as a Mormon. Tell us about growing up.
I grew up in Idaho, Twin Falls, Idaho. I'm the fifth of six children. I spent the first, although we lived in the city, I basically spent the first 6 years of my life on a little farm outside of Twin Falls.
What kind of farm? Potato?
No, we didn't grow potatoes. I mean, that's the stereotype of Idaho farmer, but we couldn't afford. You have to have a lot of equipment to grow potatoes, so we grew the cheap crops. It was a great family. I'm still very close to my brothers and sisters. My parents have both passed away. My dad was a musician, but that was always his second job. That was the thing he did consistently for 50 years, but that was always his second job.
What do you play?
Bass. He played actually tuba, and he played string bass, but he was most known for string bass.
This is for orchestra or for little bands?
Little band. He had a band. All while I was a kid, he had a band. They used to rehearse at the house. And then that gradually kind of got smaller and smaller, and at the end it was just like a trio.
Was it folk songs or folk music? Or
jazz.
Jazz.
Dance.
Oh, jazz dance.
Yeah. He played all I grew up listening to Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra and the big bands, Duke Ellington, Count Basie. They were my heroes.
In Twin Falls.
In Twin Falls, Idaho. Yeah. And it was a great childhood. When you grow up in a family that's Mormon, that's a part of your life. My mother took us to church every Sunday. It was just kind of what we did. My dad didn't go. That's an interesting story in itself, but my dad didn't go. But we used to have a lot of religious discussions.
Was he raised LDS himself?
Yeah, he was raised LDS.
Okay.
But he usually worked. He played on Saturday nights until like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. And Sunday was really his only day off. The only day it was really, because he was either a farmer or a grocer, or he was always working except Sunday. So that was his one day that he could be home and rest. And so he did his thing on Sunday and we did ours.
Is that hard for you? It's like to wonder why isn't dad part of this? And
it was hard at times. I understand now. My dad had a lot of problems, personal problems with the church, issues of the church. I mean, he had people behind the scenes and behind his back saying negative things about him because he played in a nightclub where they had drinking and smoking, and that was, you know, that made him a bad person. And there was a lot of hypocrisy from various sides about my dad.
But he loved the music.
He loved the music. He loved the people. He loved people. I mean, people, he was really good to people and for people, and he did a lot of great things for people in his life. But he didn't believe that you could just be a good person by going to church on Sunday and then, you know, treating people badly at other times. And he really showed by example. I know growing up that he used to help out poor people a lot. And which probably a really good example to me is why I really want to try to help people with what I have if I can. But he a lot of years he owned a grocery store. When we didn't own a farm, we owned a grocery store. And it kind of went back and forth. So, and he'd have people who'd come into the grocery store, and he didn't just give them money. He wouldn't give them money. He would go around and he would give them food so that they could have food to take home. And he was really careful on how he helped people, to try to help them better their life and not just give them money, which is probably something I should learn from. But he was a great example on how to treat humanity and how to treat people for who they are and what they are. But he didn't come to my, you know, when I was ordained a deacon or a teacher, or when I was, you know, my priesthood things, he didn't come to those. And that, you know, it kind of, I mean, I got used to it, but at first it kind of bothered me. He didn't come to any of my school concerts and stuff like that. And that bothered me a little bit, but looking back now, I totally understand. And the things that he taught me were so much more valuable than sitting there with the glowing smile. And he was a very good father. He really took care of his family. He worked hard, really hard, to take care of his family. He taught us a lot of great lessons on life and how to treat each other and how to be good people, good citizens. My mother was a wonderful mother. She was probably one of the best homemakers I've ever known. She was a great cook. She was very tidy. I mean, she used to come here and stay, and I would always freak out when she would come to stay, because I wanted to make sure everything was perfect, because she was a perfectionist in that way.
Right.
She never found fault, ever. She wouldn't do that, but I always was very keen on making sure everything was just so for her.
What did religion mean to her?
The church was very important to her. It was my dad, for my father, religion was how you treat people in your personal relationship with God or spirituality or whatever. For my mother, it was doing everything the church told you to do, you know, having your jobs in the church, going to church, making sure you know, there were things that, you know, I was asked to, when you're first asked to give speeches and talks in church and everything, and I wanted to get out of it. My mother made sure I didn't. She said, no, that's what you're asked to do that, you do that. It was very important for her. It was very important for her to raise her kids in the church, and we were all raised in the church.
She teach you to pray and read the scriptures and stuff like that?
Yeah. We all went, when in Idaho, seminary was not in the school. You had to go early. When I was in high school, I went to early seminary, because I went to early seminary, and then I went to early jazz band and then school. So I had an hour or an hour and a half of seminary, and then an hour to an hour and a half of music, and then school. So I don't even remember what mornings looked like when I was. I just remember getting up really, really early.
You still wake up early?
I still wake up early. Yeah. I learned how to have to exist on not a lot of sleep.
Sure. At what did the church ever end up kind of sinking in for you in those early years and being a really important part of your identity or your spirituality or your worldview? Was it, how important was it to you back then?
Well, it was like the only thing I had. I mean, you know, you in Twin Falls, Idaho, the Mormon church is not the predominant church, although it is one of the predominant churches. But most of my friends were not LDS. And I had LDS friends and I had non-LDS friends. So, I mean, it of course, it gives you a part of your identity. It's, of course, it's part of who you are. It's what you believe. It's what you're taught. I just kind of did what I was told, and there were times I just didn't want to go to church at all, but I went. There were a lot of things but did I question the church at that time? No, I didn't question it. There were things that I didn't want to do, and I did them anyway, because I was told to, and maybe because I didn't want to disappoint my mother. But as far as, I mean, I didn't really learn anything about personal spirituality for a lot of years after that.
So you'd never had sort of this teenage moment where you really wanted to know it was true for yourself. And so you prayed and read your scriptures a lot and felt some type of confirmation or whatever that.
Nope. That I didn't care about that until I was on a mission. And that's the first time I ever really wanted to have that sense of anything.
Did you, so you went to BYU?
I went to BYU. Most of my good friends went to University of Idaho, and I came to Provo and went to BYU.
Was that hard?
The first year, I have to say, the first year was hell.
Was Wilkinson the president back then?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was. And after him, then Dallin Oaks.
And you said your first year was hell?
Hell.
Just because you missed everybody, or?
It was just like, I mean, it was like going, I lived in a family that we knew what we were supposed to do, but we had, you know, you explained, you're supposed to do this, it was explained to you why it was important that you do this. You weren't just told, do this, do this, do this. And I got to BYU, I felt like, is this a school or is this military? I mean, this was like, there's this rule, there's this rule, there's this rule. So, my freshman year, I refused to go to church, which caused some problems, but I just refused to go. I mean, if I'm not going to go just because you insist that I go. I mean, this isn't, you know, you don't own me, you do not control me. So, I just refused to go.
Now you were a good student.
I was a good student. I was there. One of the reasons I went to BYU is I had a 4-year full ride academic scholarship. And I majored in music, and I majored in math first because my ACT scores were like off the charts in math. But I didn't like math, and so after the first year I changed to music, and then I started to like BYU more, and I got because of the music program I developed new friendships, and then it became much better. What? And when I was a junior, I actually started going to church. Then after my junior year, then I went on a mission. So
okay, what were the instruments you played?
I played, my major instrument was clarinet, saxophone. I was a woodwind major. That means you play clarinet, saxophone, the flute, the bassoon, the oboe.
All of them?
Yeah.
So you play multiple instruments?
Yeah.
And that was true in junior high and high school?
I played clarinet and sax in junior high and high school. And then when I got to BYU, I expanded that.
Did you ever, what did you get from music?
What did I get from music?
Personally, yeah, playing.
Music was like my escape. It was like my cloud that I could go to and just kind of be me and express it gave me freedom to express my feelings, to get inside myself, to I feel sorry for people who don't have music in their life because it can be such a wonderful bridge between your brain and your heart, and really help you develop your senses. And that's what it did for me. I mean, I loved music. I love music now. It's people ask me what kind of music, what's my favorite music. That's really hard because I like it all.
Sure.
Any quality music genre, I like.
You love. So it was an escape, and it was probably a form of creative expression for you. Form of entertainment and joy and all that, right?
All of that.
Yeah. So you decided to serve a mission.
Yeah.
What led to you making that decision? Was that back in the day where everyone went their second year at BYU?
That was back in the day when everybody, especially people at BYU, guys at BYU, when they turned 19, they went on a mission. And I turned 19 and I didn't want to go. And
how come?
Then, you know, there's a lot of pressure, peer pressure. So I will admit that one of the reasons I went was because of peer pressure. But then I had good friends that had been on a mission, and then I had a really good friend who was going on a mission. And so I decided, you know, I should do this. And so I did. I went to Italy. It was I was a good missionary. I worked hard. I came home with a burning testimony of the church.
How'd you go from sort of a non-testimony to a burning testimony?
You know, when you, I'll be crass about it, but when you hold somebody underwater long enough, they'll eventually take the water in. It was like people say, well, you had a testimony. Well, yeah, but...
Tell us first how you obtained it from the standpoint of obtaining it, and then we'll talk about how you reflect upon it at the time, if you don't mind.
If you pray about something and you want something, and you really want it, you'll get it.
So you find yourself saying, I want the confirmation.
Everybody, the scriptures say I can have it, this confirmation, everything. So if you pray about it enough, you'll get it.
Do you remember the day you prayed?
No.
Okay.
But it took time. But when you're a missionary and you're out there every day telling people how true it is, and you're bearing your testimony every day, it just becomes part of you. And you really, it just becomes part of your core. The church knows that. That's why they push the missionary program so hard on these kids. They want that burning testimony in those people.
Yeah. The missionary program is as much for the kids.
Absolutely. Yeah, the missionary program is absolutely as much for the missionary as it is for the converts that they bring in. Because the church's goal is to have those. They take young men between 19 and 21. What else are they going to do when they're 19 and 21? Oh, they might go do this. Oh, they might go do this. You know, that's like their years when they're really figuring out who they are. They want to take those and mold those kids in those 2 years. And this is a great way to do it. It's like a super sales program.
Right.
So that's what they do. I mean, it's a great experience, but it's really tailored for what it does.
Right. And for you, the program worked. You felt like you had a strong spiritual manifestation, a strong commitment, a strong desire to serve God. You were in Italy, right?
Yeah.
Well, how'd you find the Italian people?
Crazy. The crazy Italians. that they're wonderful, crazy. I love it. I love Italy now. But I love Italy now for what it is. At the time, I loved it and was trying to change it. One person at a time, trying to convince them that the church that they had gone to all their life, the Catholic Church, and had generation after generation after generation invested in Catholicism, and trying to convince them that that was the great whore of the earth, because that's what we were told. So I was, you know, if you go to Italy and you baptize 5 or 6 people, you're a success. Mm. So I was a success. And I learned a lot. I learned that, you know, there's things in other countries that are just as good as, that are there, that are just as good as the things we have here, which I think is a very important lesson for people to learn.
How was the language? Was it hard to learn, or did you learn pretty quickly?
The first 6 months were really hard, but then I started working more with the local people, and then all of a sudden that just snapped. And that was like, there was like 1 month, and it just kicked in. And I can still speak Italian.
You still speak it?
Mm-hmm.
You go back occasionally?
Every chance I get.
So you came home from your mission.
Went back to BYU.
And what was your worldview or perspective upon returning to BYU?
I remember having a hellfire damnation talk with my father, which I now regret. But
where you called him to repentance.
I called him to repentance and told him he needed to pay his tithing. He needed to become a full member of the church. And he did.
After your your admonitions?
I don't know if he did it for me, but I think he did it more for my mother, I hope.
Because you don't want to feel guilty? Is that what you mean by I hope?
My father was such a better person than so many of the tithe-paying Mormons that I know that I really, you know, I had no right to call him to repentance. But I did. And you come back with this, you know, this fire in you. I went back to BYU and I resumed my degree in music, got that. Then they had me directing the marching band. So I did that. I directed the Cougar Marching Band for 5 years. And that was a great experience. That was a really good experience for later years and doing Word Perfect and so on.
Was Lavelle Edwards there by then? Or is this before?
Yeah,
okay.
He was still there.
So the football team was starting to do well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we went to bowl games almost every year. We went to
the
bowl
Holiday
games.
Bowl in San Diego? Or?
Well, in Phoenix and San Diego. And we went to Nixon's inaugural parade.
Really?
We did. We went coast to coast, border to border. We went all over the country.
Hmm.
We went to Disney World. Went to Disneyland. I mean,
and you were like ahead, marching them, like
I was the director.
Him. So
I wrote the shows. I wrote the music. I wrote what they did on the field. I wrote what they played. I directed them. I taught them, and then
Do you bought them? Do you buy the music or write?
No, I
the
wrote
music?
The music.
How do you write the music?
I arranged the music
for all the different instruments.
Yeah, I arranged the music.
That's too much work.
Well, they paid me $1,500 a semester.
So you're writing, you pick the songs, and then you're writing all the parts of all the instruments.
I had to design the show. I had to design the show. Sometimes I would hire somebody else to write the music for the shows. I would choose the music selection and ask them basically to orchestrate it. When you orchestrate it, you take the musical ideas and then you write it out for the various instruments. So I would do that, or I would just write it all myself. You started that in the spring and you did it all summer. That was the summer. And
preparing.
A lot of hours. And at the same time I was pursuing a master's degree in music.
And did you pick the students and select them and all that?
No, there was no audition for marching band. It's pretty much, you just let anybody come.
Who was choreographer? Like how they marched.
I did that.
You did all that too?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the highlight of your, if there was sort of one moment that was sort of the peak or the highlight for you? Is there one you can single out or?
Mm. No.
Or a couple memories that were just.
I remember writing a show. I remember that my favorite show was a show of Stevie Wonder music. And that was always my favorite. And then just a few weeks ago, I actually got to meet Stevie Wonder.
Oh.
So that was kind of that was my favorite show, and I loved his music. And
So do you remember some of the songs you played that they may have performed?
That we did?
Yeah.
Superstition, Higher Ground.
That's great.
So those were good years. Those were fun. I met my wife. She was a member of this Cougar band, and we were friends. We never really dated, but I made a decision to, because, you know, when you're at that time, if you're over 25 and you're single and you're male, you are told that you're a detriment to society. Those words were actually preached from the pulpit during General Conference. So I was 27, 26, 27, 28, still single. My mother would always say, shouldn't you be getting married? Shouldn't you be getting married? Who are you dating? And so I really did love Melanie. I really do love Melanie still. And I said, well, you know, if I'm going to get married, then the only person, the only woman on earth that I can even imagine being with is Melanie. It was the right, of that decision, it was the right decision. She's a wonderful woman. She's a wonderful mother. She's a wonderful friend still to me. So.
Well, let's turn now that we kind of have a good grasp for your early years and kind of what brought you up to the times of WordPerfect. Maybe let's turn the page a little bit and talk about how things led to WordPerfect getting formed. How'd that all start?
Well, it started, I guess, when I met Alan Ashton, and I was a music student, and I wanted to, because I did the choreography for the band, I wanted to computerize that. I wanted to have to computerize it so that the computer could help teach the shows to the students and help me so that I could write it faster, easier.
Okay. And this is around what year that you started thinking about using a computer for your marching band?
Mid-70s.
So there were computers at BYU in the 70s? Like, I would think, I know that IBM didn't come, the PC didn't come around until the, you know, early 80s. To mid-80s. Yeah.
But no, I mean, there were computers around. There were computers around since the 50s.
Right. At BYU.
Well, I don't know how long at BYU, but they had massive computers. I mean, in the 60s, they had massive computers. Everything, when you went to enroll and you selected classes, you went and picked the computer cards.
Punch cards?
Punch cards. And that's how you enrolled. You picked the punch card for the class you wanted to be in. And then you submitted that, and that's how you got your schedule. So I was pursuing my master's degree in music, and but the music department decided that they needed, for accreditation, they needed to have someone with a PhD. Well, you couldn't even get a PhD in music at BYU at the time. You couldn't get a PhD in computer science at BYU at the time. But anyway, the music department told me that they weren't going to renew my contract. So I had a new wife and a new baby and decided to change everything and flip it. So I went over and went and talked to the people I knew at the computer science department and basically took everything I had been doing and swapped it over into a computer science master's program with a minor in music. So instead of getting a master's in music with a minor in computer science, I did the opposite.
So was that band program your thesis, your master's
yep.
thesis? Okay.
I still did it. I finished it. Nobody ever used it, but I did it. And I was very proud of that. So anyway, I was able to finish that. And as I was finishing up the master's program, and Alan Ashton became my thesis advisor, So my relationship with him, instead of just being my teacher, he became my advisor. And when I lost my job teaching the band, then they hired me in the computer science department to be a teaching assistant in the computer science department. So that was good. I had no idea that being fired being fired from Cougar Band was actually one of the biggest blessings of my life.
Even though it meant everything to you at the time.
Oh, it broke my heart. Yeah. It destroyed me. I mean, I had given my life and soul to that band for 5 years. I had worked for practically nothing. I mean, I was a graduate student. I was doing what a lot of men directors got a lot of money for as a band director. And I was doing it for peanuts. But I loved it, so I did it. But then, as I finished up the master's program, of course, then you start looking for jobs. And I interviewed with all the big ones, and IBM, and Hewlett Packard, and Digital Equipment, then Alan said, "Well, I have this idea. I have a friend from California has this idea. We maybe going to write a word processor." And we have a one firm customer, which is Hill Air Force Base in Ogden. So if you want to stay around Utah, we could offer you maybe a competitive salary. A competitive salary then was like $25,000 a year, which wasn't a lot of money, but it was good money then.
Sure.
And we could offer that to you if you want to stay around. So I thought about a lot of things, and I went to interview, and I went to California, and the one job that really tempted me was with Hewlett Packard in Palo Alto. And Palo Alto's beautiful, and I looked around, but I really wanted to be able to have a house. I really wanted to, you know, be able to provide for my family as well as my father had provided for us. And I looked at how much the cost of living was in the Bay Area, and it just really scared me. I just didn't know how I would, even though the job at HP seemed like it would have been secure, and it would have been, I decided to stay here. So I stayed here, and I met Alan's partner, who was from California, and he was the money man. He was the guy who was putting up all the funds. He was also going to be the marketing genius of this venture. And Alan was the man who was, he had designed what the software was designed, what was going to happen. And I was going to be the guy, I was going to be the grunt guy, the programmer who made it work, took the ideas and actually did it. So that's where we started. We rented an office in Provo, and we did that. But I kept waiting for the computer to show up, I was in this room reading it, basically kind of memorizing the instruction manuals, but I had nothing to do. And then I said, well, you know, I called Alan, and I said, well, you know, I didn't get paid. I haven't been paid. So we called Don. That was his name. And, I won't tell you his last name to protect the guilty. But we called him, and he said, well, I don't really have any money, and so we have to fold this. So I was suddenly without a job.
Mm.
And so Alan helped me get a job at Irene Research in Provo. And I started working there. And then they came. I was working on language translation, which was really boring, and I had this, it was in an awful language, and anyway. So the management of Irene came, and they said, well, we have a different project. Totally unrelated, but Orem, the city of Orem, has contracted with us to buy a computer, but part of the package, we have to provide the computer, but it has to have a word processor on it. And the computer was a Digital Equipment MD-11 mini computer. A mini computer for people who don't understand, it's like one big computer, and people hook just terminals. And the terminal basically is just, it's like a monitor and a keyboard now. It gets stuff to display on the monitor from the mini computer, and it takes the keyboard and input. There's no mouse still. It takes the keyboard and stuff input and gives it to the mini computer. So the monitor is one entity as far as the mini computer that is concerned. So that's, I don't know if they had 50, 60, they had a lot. So that's where I sat in the basement of Orem City for months writing this program. Those are really interesting days. Those are really difficult days, discouraging days. Alan was a teacher at BYU. I was technically an employee of Irene Research. But we had made a deal with Irene Research because it was Alan's idea, and he had made all the plan of what it does and how it did, how it's supposed to work. The deal was that we would write it for Orem City, and Orem City would get the money, or Orem City would pay Irene for this product. But when we were done, Alan and I would own the rights of this product, not Irene Research.
And Alan was okay with you owning that, sharing the ownership?
Yes.
Even though you were just a, you know...
Well, the idea that this came... I brought Alan back into this...
Oh.
I brought Alan back into the scenario. Because they came to me, Irene Research came to me and said, we know you've had experience in doing word processing. And I said, well, the only experience I've had is working with Alan Ashton on it. So I can't do it without Alan.
Because he designs?
He designed it.
Okay.
So I said, we can only do this if Alan and I are an entity. So we set up our own entity. And this entity owned it. And years later, in lawsuits, I had the paper signed by Irene, and that saved us.
Because they tried to later come back and...
They didn't. Don did.
Okay. Oh.
The guy who originally said he was going to fund it all, he came back years later and said he deserved a third of it, which that didn't even make it through. That was out the door really fast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that piece of paper saved us from that.
Oh.
But those were hard. We got to the point where Irene Research called me in and said, well, as far as we're concerned, we've talked to Orem City and it's done. It meets all the criteria for them, and we want you to come back and work on something else now. So I quit.
Right.
I didn't have any other choice. I said, well, according to Alan and me, it's not done. So we need to do more. So I had no choice but to quit. So I quit. Then I went home and called my dad. I said, I have no income. I think I had at least two kids by then. So my dad gave me a $3,000 loan, and I had other friends and family, and we ate out of garden pickings that summer. But I finished it. And then at the end of that summer, I can't remember. I think it was 79. I can't remember. 79. I'll just say it was 79 or 80. And, we sold the first copy to Hill Air Force Base, which is the one entity that was interested in it from the beginning. And a lot of what we put into it because we knew Hill Air Force Base would buy it if it had these certain things in it, like the merge. The merge and the macros.
Mail merge?
Mail merge and the macros. We were the first program ever for sale that had macros in them, that had merge in them, to merge in, to create letters and billings and everything automatically. WordPerfect did that in 1980.
Hmm.
And it did it the same as it does now, same code.
Hmm.
But that was really slow because our customers were Data General people. And so it was like every single sale was important. I remember a sale in Buffalo, New York that was just really important, and a sale in Rochester, New York, and a sale in several in California and Colorado, and once one in Denver that was just, every sale was important. And so we started bringing in a few other people.
Did you have competitors when you started selling this? Was there any other word processor on the market?
Not on Data General. I mean, Data General didn't have one. In the mini computer market, no. There wasn't anything like it at all.
Okay. So you're the first word processor on a mini?
Yeah.
Okay.
As far as I know.
Okay.
And then in 1984, 83, when the PC was announced, one of our Data General customers called and said, you guys need to go buy this new IBM PC and take a look at it. Well.
Now, by this time, how big was the company?
Oh, I think we were four.
People?
Two, three, four, five, maybe five people.
Okay.
We had our own office. We could barely afford our own office.
So you were barely getting by at this point.
Yeah, we were struggling. There were in those few years, Alan. There were three times when Alan wanted to just fold and just. I mean, he said, you know, he had his job.
It's not worth it.
It wasn't worth the headache and the stress, and it just was every. We worked long, long hours, and there was no income for Alan, no income, very little for me or anyone else.
Wow, you just did it. Did you have this big vision, or did you just love it, or what kept you going? I'm sure you didn't envision the multi-million or billion-dollar opportunity.
It got to a point where it was becoming easier to sell. It was obviously a really good product. The people who used it loved it.
Mm-hmm.
It was providing an income, not a great income, but an income, certainly as good an income as I could have got if I had folded up and gotten a job with IBM or anything. It's probably as good as I could have gotten.
You enjoyed the work?
And I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it. I enjoyed going to work. But when the PC was announced, then we had to totally retune everything.
Real quick, had Apple come out with any of its offerings yet?
I think some of the Apples preceded
the PC, right?
I think the Apple, the little Apple, was out. I think it was, but it was still considered expensive, and it was still considered a niche product that was, you know, it was kind of like. It's like Steve Jobs' baby, and I think that's one of the reasons IBM got the personal computer out.
Did you ever consider a version of WordPerfect for the Macintosh back then, way back in those early years?
No, we eventually, when WordPerfect became successful, we had a Mac version, but that was, but not, we did the PC version first.
Okay. So someone told you about the PC.
We bought one. We went down to...
It was an 8088. IBM XT, whatever.
Yeah, I think it had a five megabyte hard drive. I remember when they came out with the 10 megabyte hard drive, we thought, wow, this is great. 10 megabyte. Now, that's 10,000 bytes. Now you get a computer with a trillion bytes on it.
Yeah, sure. What did you think of the PC?
I thought it was interesting. It had some challenges. I mean, we had to basically rewrite WordPerfect to make it work on the PC. So Alan had a student that was a brilliant student. His name was Alan Brown. And we talked to Alan and hired Alan. We couldn't afford a desk, so we took two piles of boxes and put a door. We took the door off the hinges, put the door on these boxes, and put the PC on it, and said, here you go. Here's your office. Make it work. So we worked really hard. Alan was great, and so I worked with Alan, and we ported it off over. And then you have all these other problems. So now we had a word processor on the PC. We didn't know what to call it.
Running on DOS, right? Disk Operating System 1, DOS 1.0.
I don't know what.
And this is pre-graphical user interface, so this is all.
It's no mouse. It's just keyboard.
Just characters.
Yeah. Which is why the function keys, WordPerfect still uses the function keys. And the function keys were really important because you didn't have a mouse that you could just move around and click on things. You needed a way to input commands.
Right.
So you had the function key, the shift function key, control, yeah. Alt, and you had.
And you'd have to lay your little template on top of your keyboard.
Yeah, that was part of it. That was part of what you shipped. You shipped the software and you shipped the overlay for that.
Little template.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those of us who use WordPerfect would have to memorize Control-F7 was, you know, Control-F8 was save and Control-F7 was print and Shift-F5 was, you know.
Yeah, I still use those.
Did I get a
roll? Luckily, Corel just announced WordPerfect 15 and they still have those keyboards. Thank God they still use those keyboards so I can, all my shortcuts. It's still much faster than using a mouse. I mean, if I want to print, I just push Shift F7, boom, it's print. I get the print menu up. So that was one of our fortes. But we had competitors in the PC market. I mean, not really competitors, but the main problem in the PC market was marketing, because you had these stores and the stores were basically full, and the stores wanted to stock stuff that they could sell.
Boxes.
So it's shelf space, just like it is now.
Right.
And the stores will stock what will sell, what will make them money, what's easy for them to sell. So then we came up with the idea of, well, if you sell our stuff, you don't have to install it, you don't have to support it. You just tell them to call this 800 number.
Mm.
So we invented online support.
Really?
We invented the 800 toll-free support for software.
Mm.
We were the first company. We used to have Microsoft users calling WordPerfect to help them install DOS.
With DOS.
Because they couldn't get any help from Microsoft. So they would call WordPerfect. But we started it anyway. So that was our sales job to the stores. And if you sell this, then, you know, they just call this 800 number. And this is what they just take this box home and you can just wash your hands of it. You just say, call WordPerfect. So.
Do you remember Gates and Bomber in those early years at all? Like, were they just kind of no names, small players?
No, they were not no names. They were big players, but they had what they did and they, you know, I mean, Bill Gates was revered from the time Microsoft started.
Did you ever have early meetings with them to try and negotiate stuff, or were they friendly? Were they friendly to you?
My associates had meetings with them. I only had a couple of meetings with Bill. I saw him at Sundance this year. He didn't know me from Adam.
Oh, really?
He didn't recognize, and I had no desire to talk to him. But.
Oh.
I saw him. He was there.
He would remember your name, but
probably.
Okay. So you weren't thinking about them when you were working on the PC. You were just trying to make the best.
All Microsoft was the operating system. That's all they were. They had no application software.
Right.
So WordPerfect, just in a real quick scenario here, that the dealers started loving to sell WordPerfect because it was easy. They didn't have to support it. And it had a good reputation. It was a solid product. People liked it. And so word of mouth just started spreading and spreading and spreading. So then there was another company, Lotus, in Massachusetts, who wrote a spreadsheet called 123. And they were a really solid company, and they started selling it too. So you had WordPerfect and Lotus. And you had people buying the PC because they could put WordPerfect and Lotus on the PC. So we were selling machines, and we were selling DOS so people could use. We weren't selling it, but we were the catalyst.
You were the reason they wanted to buy a PC.
We were the reason they wanted to buy a PC.
So they could do spreadsheets and write letters and do word processing.
Yeah. And that was like the beginning of the personal computer revolution.
Were you the first word processor on the PC then?
No. There was... WordStar.
That's right. That's right.
There was WordStar and Xyrite and. But I mean, there were no computer, there were no programs where you could just sit down and just write it, and you know, and as you could just move the cursor here and just put something in, and there was nothing like that. I mean, we had headers and footers and footnotes, and
were you the first to do WYSIWYG kind of?
Yeah, we were the first to do WYSIWYG.
What you see is what you get on the screen.
But, I mean, it wasn't the beautiful, because the monitors then were just ASCII.
Right.
You couldn't have the nice, beautiful
Windows and
bitmap displays like you have now.
Right.
So it was WYSIWYG in the sense that when you saw a page break, that is where the page break. When you saw the end of sentence, that's where the sentence actually would end when it was printed.
When it was printed.
And if you went back and inserted something, all that would change dynamically, just as it does now.
Right.
But we were the only ones that did that.
Right.
We were the first to do that. So it was really revolutionary. It really did change the way people wrote and how they ran their offices and everything. We had legal offices, law offices all over the country, all over the world, actually, using WordPerfect, because we had such strong footnoting and annotation capability.
And good customer support. And
yeah.
Good features. So I imagine the PC is what took you from a door over a couple of chairs as your table to, I guess, being very 7, successful.
7,000 employees, offices around the world, money coming in.
So what's that like? A farm boy from Idaho, loves music and band, kind of almost stumbled into computers, just did it as a passion. And then all of a sudden, as a major technological revolution hits both the private and the public, you know, the consumer and the commercial markets, you're right there in the middle of it. This Mormon boy from Idaho living in Utah. And now you've gone from just you and Alan hacking on some stuff to like having to manage a multinational corporation with 7,000 employees. Like, was that a hard transition? Or did you just love it every step of the way?
You know, when it was growing and everything, it was exciting. It was fun. You just kind of hold on and you learn. You learn as you go. And we learned that we didn't know everything. It was one of the best management experiences anyone could have. The best managers hire people who can do things that they can't. And the worst managers, and you see it all over the place, the worst managers hire people and then try to dictate everything they do. And they don't let them actually be creative at all. And so you kind of pigeonhole people into doing things, and you don't give them any way to grow. And so your company doesn't grow either. So it was exciting to bring in people, great people in programming, in marketing. And we really developed a lot. We brought in people who knew a lot about telecommunications, because we started doing that. I mean, it was wild. It was fun. It was great.
Was it hard to deal with the money, just the volume of money? You know, who's prepared for that, for just becoming successful that way with that volume of success?
I don't think any. You have to stop and remember, if you let the money become the reason for doing it all, then I think you're on a quick road to a cliff. But if you try to keep a perspective of, you know, the money's just a nice, it's nice. It's nice to have money, but it's not, it was never the reason why we did it. We never dreamed of being millionaires. That was not the goal. We wanted to be able to take care of our families. We wanted to be able to take care of our employees. We wanted to make sure they had good salaries, good benefits, that kind of stuff.
Did you feel a great sense of responsibility for your employees?
Oh, yeah.
It's like a family, like a 7,000
member? It was
like
a big family.
Yeah. Was it fun in those days?
It was fun until Microsoft started giving away Word and Excel. And both Lotus and WordPerfect took a lot of losses because of that.
And this was pre-Windows, right?
No, this was when Windows, after Windows.
Okay, so Microsoft. So
Microsoft did develop Word for DOS. Maybe people don't remember that. It did nothing. It just fell. It was never. They even gave it away. Nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted to use it.
Let me explain something to our listeners. So back in the day, before we had Windows or the Mac operating system, all you had was sort of a black screen with a little flashing character prompt, and you'd have to type in messages, and WordPerfect sort of took you out of that character prompt mode, which was the disk operating system. But at some point, Microsoft developed something called Windows, which was a graphical user interface where you had this little mouse, and you could point and click with a little pointer, and all of a sudden you could have graphics and visual images. It was quite exciting. So Microsoft ships Windows,
yeah,
and all of a sudden your world is a little bit different because you'd been writing to DOS.
Yeah.
And so, there was OS 2, which was a competing operating system that IBM was trying to develop.
Correct, because IBM didn't want to keep giving royalties to Microsoft for DOS or Windows.
So they developed a competing operating system to DOS.
Correct, which never took off either.
But then Microsoft came out with Windows. So what did that do?
The first Windows ran on top of DOS, so people could still use their DOS programs. So people still used WordPerfect on DOS and used Windows for other things. And the first Windows was a lot better than DOS, granted. Well, and for certain things. And Microsoft wanted us to put WordPerfect on Windows, but they were so restrictive then on what you could do and everything, that's when I got into one argument with Bill Gates. And we were in Las Vegas and we were having a meeting, and he said, "We really want you to put WordPerfect onto Windows." And I said, "Well, you need to let us do some things so that we can allow the users to do things the way they want. Instead of restricting what they do, you need to open it up a little bit." And he just got up and left. It made him mad that I would say, "You know, I don't like Windows the way it is. We need to have it do more." And he left.
Just got up and left.
He got up and left. And so that didn't go real well. We did put it onto Windows, and it was a good product on Windows. But we still had to charge for that on Windows. And Microsoft started shipping Word and Excel to anyone who bought Windows, because they were selling Windows then. It didn't just come automatically. Then when it got to the time when they shipped Windows automatically with the computers, and Windows automatically included Word and Excel, then we thought, "Oh God, what do we do now?"
Because they'd make a deal with the hardware manufacturers,
yeah,
to ship Windows and Word and Excel
as one package.
As one package.
That's how you got the PC.
And so they bundled it.
Mm-hmm. Whether it was from IBM or Toshiba or any of the many, many manufacturers of PCs by then.
And were some of your employees going over to Microsoft to help with Word? Were they kind of hoping to bring some of your people over to help them do what
you've
been
doing? Well, we had some employees go to Microsoft. I don't know how extensive that was, but
they had more leverage with the hardware manufacturers than you did.
Because
you had to go sell through retail channels while they just shipped it on the native on the.
Exactly.
And did you ever try and get shipped native on the PC?
We tried to bundle. We tried to bundle with some manufacturers, but
Compaq was the big one at the time, right?
Compaq was a big one.
Yeah.
In Houston. And that was good, but see, Compaq still had to get Windows. They still had, so they had two bundles they had to put on. So even though it was good for us, it just wasn't enough. So then we had to start looking for partners, and that was in 93.
What's it like to build something so successful, the premier product for its function, to see it distributed all around the world in multiple languages, to have 7,000 employees, to reach that sort of pinnacle of success in your field, and then to sort of start seeing the tide turn. Was that hard?
That was really hard. Well, it was frustrating, and it made it made me really angry because Microsoft wasn't playing on a level playing field. You know, if you put two people down, WordPerfect on Windows and Word on Windows, you still can. Put two people down with WordPerfect and Word on Windows. WordPerfect can still outdo it. Now, all these years later, it can still do things that Word cannot do. But that wasn't the point. The point was, well, why should I spend another $200 or another $150 when I have this other product that, you know, 90% of people, what do? They write something, you know, they print it, mail it, or now they email it, and they're done.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, very few people need to put in a lot of headers and footers or put graphics in the middle of it and do all this stuff.
Tables and
pictures and...
Yeah. So do you have to just develop this sense of, well, I'm grateful it was a craft, I'm an engineer, I'm proud of what we did, and yeah, they beat us in the end, but I'm proud of what we did, or...
I'm very proud of what we did. I'm very proud of the company we built. I'm very proud of the products we developed. I understand, you know, it wasn't anything personal. It was a business thing. But you know, to sell it to Novell is very interesting because we could have also sold it to Lotus. Lotus actually offered us more money than Novell, which very, very few people know. And we sat in a room and decided we should go with Novell because they're local and people won't have to move out of Utah. Their jobs will be safe here with Novell. Big mistake.
Mm.
Big mistake.
Were there any other big strategic decisions you made in those years that you look back now and think could have made things really different? Or
yeah, we could have. I mean, there was a time when we could have bought Novell and we could have been in charge of the whole scene instead of them buying us. And there was one person in our executive team that really torpedoed that idea. Another bad decision.
Okay. And then selling to Novell instead of Lotus 1-2-3. But Lotus ended up losing too in the end.
Lotus ended up losing too. IBM bought them. I don't even know if you can still get Lotus. Thank goodness Novell basically gave WordPerfect to Corel, and Corel still manufactures it, still sells it, and
sure.
I buy it.
And you buy it. You still use it.
I actually buy it. I use it. It's still really a lot better on networking and stuff, I think, than Word.
Sure. We can talk about a little bit about how that eventual descent, but what did you ever get a sense for what WordPerfect meant to Utah and even to the church? And were there ever any interesting interplays between WordPerfect and the church, the LDS church, that are worth noting?
I don't know. I know WordPerfect meant a lot to Utah. I know, we had people in the governor's office and the legislature, and we had a lot of people who publicly and privately acknowledged the importance of WordPerfect. I don't know about the church. I mean, by the time WordPerfect was really in its heyday, I was openly gay and I was no longer a Mormon, and anytime any conversations were between WordPerfect and a church, they were with somebody else at WordPerfect, not with me.
Right.
So probably Alan, because the church has always loved Alan Ashton.
Right.
So I don't know.
Okay. So eventually you sold to Novell. Mm-hmm. Was that hard? Was it like a death?
No, it wasn't like a death, but it was like deserting 7,000 kids. is, you know, you especially the ones outside of the United States, because Novell treated them so poorly and had no regard for what we had built up, especially in Europe.
Was it as simple as you've built this company, you've made this big investment of time and energy, and the market may or may not be going in a favorable way, so it's time to sort of capitalize? Was that kind of what led to the,
it was,
from
it was,
your perspective?
It was a decision that change was inevitable. We had to make some serious changes. And it got to the point where we either do this or we face things getting worse and worse and worse, and people, instead of changing their jobs, were just going to lose their jobs.
Right.
So it was the lesser of two evils. And but it was a business decision. And I got to the point where I had to take the people out of the decision because it had to become a business decision.
Right.
Which was not easy, but it was really something that you just have to do.
Right. And so kind of for any chance for the company to really become successful or to maintain a success or to have a chance for growth, kind of a merger was just necessary because consolidation was just the way things were moving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
We thought the merger between Novell and WordPerfect was a very natural one, because Novell had a networking software and WordPerfect was far superior in networking over Word.
Right.
And we had not only WordPerfect, but Quattro Pro and presentations. So we had a full office suite that we could offer.
Right.
And Novell just never learned how to market it. They just never understood it. And they didn't want to listen to us.
Right.
So
at your peak, what were your maximum annual revenues? Do you remember? Just approximately? Was it in the hundreds of millions?
It was in the hundreds of millions.
Okay. So we're
there was a peak when, there were times when it was like $2 or $3 million a day.
Right.
I mean, those didn't last a long time, but they
were. So 400 or 500 million a year kind of thing?
I don't know.
Half a million.
I'd have to go back. But it was a lot.
Yeah. So you, I imagine when Novell bought WordPerfect, you stayed on for a while.
I stayed on the board for a while until I realized that they really weren't interested in what I had to say. So I said, fine, I won't bother. And then I started getting more involved in my foundation. The foundation was not new. It existed then. But it had done mostly AIDS-related stuff here in Utah and in the Bay Area. And so I remember the first time I made any kind of donation, I think it was in the early 90s, and the Utah AIDS Foundation was at a crossroads and they were really having serious problems. And nobody would give them any money. And of course, the Utah legislature just shudder to think that we would help an AIDS group. So I gave them money and I gave it anonymously, but it was on every Salt Lake City TV station that night that some anonymous donor had given them money to keep them afloat.
Right.
And, that really made me feel good. I didn't care that my name wasn't there, but it made me feel good that I had kept something that I knew was very important going when all these other high and mighty people were shunning it and hoping it would fail.
Right.
So that was the start. That was the start of the foundation. And that was where it built. And then after, in 94, then we started doing more things and we started doing a lot of the arts stuff, with the ballet and the symphony and other arts groups in Utah, mostly in Utah, some other places, but mostly Utah.
So Bruce, just take a second to maybe just summarize as you reflect upon your years with WordPerfect and what you guys were able to accomplish. Do you have any thoughts or feelings or just anything you want to express?
Well, of course, it was a very important chapter in my life. I kind of have three parts of my life: the pre-WordPerfect life, the WordPerfect years and now the LGBT years. I'm very proud of what we did with WordPerfect. I mean, you look now and people, you take out your iPhone or your BlackBerry and you start, people just expect, you expect to be able to go here and put the cursor and just write. We were the first people to do that. I think it was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot about people, good things and bad things. I learned a lot about management, which I don't understand how they can teach some of the things they teach and then not focus on the value of employees and people. You can replace machines and hardware and everything. You can't replace people. And people will make you successful or they'll make you fail. And they don't teach that in MBA, I don't think. Anyway, I'm proud of it. It was a good thing. I've met a lot of good friends. I have a lot of good friends in other countries because of it. So it was a great time.
You still have friends now from who were employees back then?
I have a few people who work or did work for Novell that are still friends. I'm still friends with some of the executive team at WordPerfect. I have a good friend who lives in Holland, and I actually caught up with him in South Africa last year. He has a summer home in Holland and a summer home in South Africa, so he just stays in the summer all the time. He's a good friend, very, very good guy. Love him and his family. They're really good friends.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even a ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.
Still, all my song shall be near.